take a moment of silence opportunity to prepare for the study of the Word by making sure we're filled with the Spirit. Father, we thank you for another opportunity that you provided for us to gather together for the purpose of receiving the communication of your Word that provides us with the information we need to have in order to understand what's going on here on this earth and why, how we're to deal with it, and the resources we're to deploy in the process. We also can look at those who've gone before us and look at their examples as a point of reference for how your grace operates on our behalf in spite of our negative volition on occasion. So as we study, we ask that by means of the Spirit that the information that is communicated will subsequently be made available for recall and application. And we ask this, thank you in Jesus' name, amen. Well, we're in our study of Romans, and verse 10 of chapter 1 is where we're stopped at the moment. The verse says, always in my prayers when offering a petition, that if somehow at least I will succeed by the will of God coming face to face with you all. So we noted that Paul wrote this toward the end of his third missionary journey. And he was in near Corinth when he wrote it, which is across the sea from north of the of Jerusalem, basically. And we see here that he is seeing that it's God's will for him to go to Rome, and we're going to see that, or to Spain, actually, Rome and in Spain. So God sent Paul on the mission to find and track down positive volition. And that's what he was supposed to do. And of course, he wanted to go back to Jerusalem because that's where his homies were from. And he thought that he could come back there and influence them because he'd been such a big man on campus. So at least that's what we think. We don't really know. It doesn't say why. It just says that he did it. So the sin was in going there, and he'd been specifically told that he's going to be in trouble if he went there, as we've noted. So this verse brought out a couple of side trips, and we did a brief study on prayer that's there. We did a study on the will of God, which is relevant to our study for today, and then we're looking at the study of Paul's reversionism, where he rejected God's directive will and operated in God's permissive will to pursue his own agenda that God ultimately stopped with his overruling will. So here we see all categories of God's will operational. And so we can correlate what happened to Paul to us. It's a very good study, actually. It's fairly interesting. And to see this is the apostle to the church. Okay? This ain't no spring chicken. He's got what he's going. He knows what he's doing. And he's in the stream of communicating doctrine when he does this. So this just shows you how your emotions can drive you to do things that are contrary to God's will. Even when you're very mature. And we see that with David, for a matter of fact, you know, with his issues. So, and when you have a sensitivity towards something, that's likely where you're going to get caught. And it wasn't necessarily a wrong thing to do this. It was wrong for him. But generically, it wasn't wrong. Well, what's wrong with going to Jerusalem and witnessing? Well, it's not wrong unless God tells you not to go. Right? So it's kind of like a right thing done in the wrong way. That's what it is. And so that's the kind of thing that can catch us. A right thing done in the wrong way. Or for the wrong reason or at the wrong time. You know, it wasn't his job. In fact, we're going to see today that he should have known. Because God told him his mission field was not Jerusalem. I mean, that was straight out the box that came to him. So if he had just been the least bit of remembering or wanting to remember what Jesus personally had told him. I mean, how many of us have Jesus personally tell us that ain't where you're going? And then you go there. Hello? It would have seemed to me that would have been not the thing to do. But he did it anyway. So that tells you he's a pretty strong-willed guy. Which is probably good because it served him well in other places. So, but I'm just saying this, the issue here is for us to get a frame of reference for what we might get involved with that would be actually the kind of thing that a mature believer would do. And that could be a right thing in the wrong way or a right thing in the wrong time. So we need to be careful even about a right thing. And again, for other people, it was okay. It was okay for James to be there. It was okay for other apostles to be there. But it wasn't okay for Paul. Because his mission field was the Gentiles, and specifically Rome, and its extension. So our passage in Romans 1:10 tells us that it was God's will for Paul to go to Rome. And in Romans 15:24, which is later in the book, but he had written this all before he went. You got to remember, the book was written prior to his leaving where he was and going to Jerusalem. All right. So this book was dispatched probably to Rome prior to his leaving, because someone was probably going that way. So, because it was finished. He finished it basically in 3 months during that winter. They didn't go seafaring over there because it was very dangerous. Verse 24 of Romans 15 actually tells us. So he had recently written this. Whenever I go to Spain, I hope I'll see you. That will be the Romans in passing, and to be helped on my way by you when I have first enjoyed your company for a while. Okay. But now I'm going to Jerusalem and I'm serving the saints. All right. So, but he was serving the saints, but it wasn't for him to do. Okay. That's the point. We're going to say he wasn't doing good to them. He was bringing a bunch of cash, and I'm sure he was going to have a good time because all of his buds were there. It tells us he was not going to stay in Rome, but his ultimate destiny was Spain. And that's important because, well, what became one of the earlier, after Rome, who became a client nation? Well, it kind of was in France and Germany, Germany. Charlemagne. His place is actually in, it's right on the border. So they kind of, it goes both ways. In that time of frame, it was actually kind of France. And then in that space, after that, it kind of went to Portugal and Spain. So it kind of wrapped around there a few times. But all those had been colonies or conquered areas of Rome. They were under the aegis of Rome for a long, long time. So that's where the doctrine came from. When we stopped last time, Paul was outside of God's directive will, and geographical will, of course, in Jerusalem, and had just been placed in chains by the Roman tribune Claudius Lysias, who permitted Paul to speak to the mob that was trying to kill him under God's overruling will. Okay, so God is in the process of shutting Paul down here, and the Romans are going to come in and save his hind end. They're going to save his life. In fact, he's going to save his life twice, more than twice. We're not going to go through all of them, because we see the point here, and it's just going to become repetitive. Because he keeps, what they did do is provide him a platform for witnessing to the influential Romans in the region. All of them. So in a sense, remember, God turns the curse into a blessing. You never want to forget that. If you out of line and you get hammered and you rebound, suffering for discipline turns into suffering for blessing. So that's how he turns the curse into a blessing. So Paul actually became, remember, God knows everything. He's omniscient. But he also knows what's going to happen. So all these potentials are in line. Paul could have gone to Rome and Spain as a free person. He didn't make that choice. He went to Jerusalem instead. So he went to Rome, and I don't think he made it to Spain in restraints. Now, the restraints aren't normal. They're not. It wasn't like he was a slave. But he was a prisoner for his own safety. Okay, that's what was going on. So he was under protective custody. He's still limited, though. He can't just come and go as he wishes. In fact, he probably had to take the Praetorian Guard along with him when he went, because he's a Roman citizen under the aegis of the Roman judicial system right after this happened. And so he's under protective custody. And for good reason, because the Jews were really trying to kill him. They weren't messing around. So we were noting Paul's speech that is recorded in Acts 22, where we find the second reference to Paul's conversion experience on the road to Damascus. Remember, and this is how we see who he was. He was a big man on campus. He was involved with destroying the Christian church. And there's a word they use for it here called the way, which is what it was called. It was basically, it was Jewish people who believed in Jesus. So he says in verse 22:3. It's interesting let me back up here, just look at the first verse or two. There's a couple of things here. The verse two is interesting to say. And when they heard he was addressing them in the Hebrew dialect, they became quiet. So it's interesting that he was able to really communicate with these people. Because, why? He was from there. It wasn't like he was a stranger. So he was communicating them in their tongue, and not just their tongue, their local area. Because remember, anytime you have a language, as you go to different regions, there's a slight different twist on it. Like we go to England, it sounds different than it does here in some cases, in Australia, or even in the United States. You have the northeastern areas, like Boston, that has a certain dialect, or a way of saying things. South does the same kind of thing. And then you have kind of the Midwestern, the rest of us kind of doing the rest of it. But so he was native when he was from Tarsus, but he spent a lot of time in Jerusalem because that's where he went to college. So I'm a Jew, verse 3, born of Tarsus of Cilicia, brought up in this city, that would be Jerusalem, under Gamaliel, strictly according to the law of our fathers, being zealous for God just as you are today. Now remember, what did Jesus say about that? They have a zeal for God, but not according to knowledge. That's what Jesus said about these people. Because they were so fastidious with the law, and they thought they could be saved by keeping it. So they did serve, they served what they thought God was, but they didn't serve the true God. Jesus was the true God. And so at this point, this is before he was saved. This is as he was a hitman for the Sanhedrin at this point. So that means all these guys knew him. The Sanhedrin people. And we're going to see he goes there. This verse provides a lot of biographical information about Paul, and when compared with other passages, we learned that Paul was born in Tarsus of Cilicia. It was a cultural and economic center during Roman rule, and Paul describes himself in verse 39 of Acts 21 as, I'm a Jew of Tarsus, a citizen of no insignificant city. So Tarsus was a leading, and we see corroborating evidence to that in the records that are available. And it was also connected to Mark Antony, who was a big man on campus, as we've seen. He was the guy that pushed Rome as far east as it could go and came to a detente out there with the Babylonians. So that's why when the wise men came to Judea, it was a big thing. Because they had to cross that line. And that's why Herod was upset that they came and didn't tell him he was coming. They was coming. And then they leave without telling him too, after he specifically tells them to tell him. And they go out a different way than they came in. All right, so Herod was not happy. You know, he knew something was going on here, and that's why he went over to Bethlehem and killed all the babies. Remember? So younger than two, because he wasn't messing around. So the point is that Mark Antony was a big man. He was one of the big guys when Caesar was running the show, and he lost out when Augustus ended up in charge, because he had backed one of the other senators, Cassius, I think. So that's a real fun thing to study, the Romans and their all the things that happened to them. So it was the capital in the province of Cilicia, and for a while was the residence of Mark Antony. Remember, Mark Antony and his boys couldn't go back to Rome after they backed, like I said, I think it was Cassius instead of Augustus. Strabo, writing about 19 AD, tells us of the inhabitants and enthusiasm for learning and especially for philosophy. He says, Tarsus surpassed Athens and Alexandria, and every other university town. I mean, the big university towns for Christianity were Alexandria and Antioch. So these are the big college towns they're talking about. Now, Athens was preeminent already in its own right, but for the Christian church, the big towns in this time frame, or cities, where the universities were, again, Alexandria and Antioch. And if you go back through Christian history, you'll see that the viewpoints of doctrine come out of those two places. So that's where some of the ideas came from. The theologians in those various cities. The Catholic Church went with Alexandria, which is why they have all the ritual they have. Okay, and the principles of Antioch came into view more with the Reformation. So that's also an interesting study. So see, the history of the church and the Christian theology. That's an interesting study. On what occasion and for what service Roman citizenship had been conferred on one of Paul's ancestors, we do not know. But we know that before Paul's birth, his father was a Roman citizen, so Paul was born a Roman citizen. And that's important, as we're going to see in our story. Because the guy he's going to meet here shortly is going to, well, he's already met him, the tribune. We're going to see that he actually paid for his citizenship. Big bucks. All right? So Paul was born that way, so in a sense, that's actually a superior. Well, it's a native. You know? Well, kind of like that. I mean, somebody's born someplace is from that place because of their birth. Well, and they may have a certain perspective of superiority, even though they're probably not. The guy that comes in and buys his citizenship is probably superior because he's not lazy. Natives tend to be lazy, unfortunately. At least in a declining client nation like we got. So we learn from also from Acts 22:3 that Paul studied in Jerusalem under Gamaliel, who was highly respected by the Jews because of his knowledge of the law. And remember, the Pharisees were hooked up with the law. That was their thing. That was their. The Pharisees were not qualified to be the high priests. The Sadducees were. They were a different line. The Sadducees were primarily comprised of the Jewish intelligentsia, and primarily of the families that could be part of the priesthood. To be a Pharisee, you didn't have to. Remember, priesthood is what? Levitical. I mean, John, the disciple John, the apostle John, was in that family. He was related to the high priest. Paul, on the other hand, he talks about his heritage other places. He was a Benjamite. Now, Benjamin was a favored son. Remember that story? You know, that's Rachel's second child, I think it was. Joseph was first. Rachel only had two kids. Not two men, two boys. We don't know how many girls they might have had. They don't keep track of them, but for the most part. But Rachel was Jacob's favorite wife. Remember, you have Rachel and Leah? And Rachel could only had two kids, Benjamin and Joseph. And Benjamin was one of his favorite children. Because remember, Joseph got sold off into Egypt. So that's how that rings into the story. Because Benjamin, the favored tribes were kind of Judah, Levi, Joseph. Now Joseph is two tribes, and Benjamin. So those were the favored tribes in Israel. And Ephraim and Manasseh were Joseph's kids. So since he was the oldest son that was the favored son, he got the double portion. So in God's, that's why there's 13 tribes of Israel, not 12. So, you know, because there's two for Joseph, Ephraim and Manasseh. So anyways, that's the side notes. Paul goes on to describe how a Pharisee himself, armed with credentials from the high priest, he had sought out and brought to trial those who were of the way. That was the phrase they used to describe Jewish people who believed in Jesus. That was how they referred to believers in the Lord Jesus Christ. So remember, the first believers in Jesus Christ were Jewish, with maybe a couple of exceptions, like maybe Luke, because he was there, but I think he was not Jewish. But the majority were, because it was in Jerusalem. That's where it happened. Well, Jerusalem and Bethlehem, and you know that region, Galilee, Jerusalem. I mean, Jesus was actually from Nazareth. This isn't far from Galilee. So it's, you can walk it. Jerusalem's quite a ways away. A good long walk. He then tells his Jewish audience that the events not only changed his mind about persecuting Christians, but also result of his own conversion, but his sentimentality for his people also leads to his disobedience to God and results in God using the Romans' divine establishment policies to restrain him for his own safety. See, so that's ultimately what happens here. This is a perfect example of a Gentile client nation who's implemented principles of establishment, saving God's people on the basis of the law, which is the way it should be. You know, what's interesting here is you've got two client nations vying at this point, because you have the Jewish client nation, which is being phased out. They're in the fourth and about to get into the fifth cycle of discipline. So they're negative volition, big time. And they're not establishment. The law system is very poor. But the Romans, on the other hand, are an ascendant client nation, or about to be, if not. Because Paul is a big guy doing that. And we've talked about the Romans' ascendancy in that regard. So the two are working in opposition here. You know, it's just kind of an interesting story. Because ultimately the Romans come over and destroy the Jews because of their emotionalism. Their religious emotionalism, because they're just arrogant. And that's what religious emotional people are like. I mean, to think about it today, the Jews of that day would be equivalent to Al-Qaeda. All right? Those kind of people. Well, what do we do with them? We kill as many as we can. Al-Qaeda and all those people, the Taliban. Taliban kind of, not quite, almost. Taliban is tied more into Afghanistan. But the outfit that built that ISIS thing, yeah, that's him. Those people, that's kind of like the Jews were back to Rome. So think about the wackoism that that has, the religious fanaticism. Well, that's what they were involved with. Verse 8, 20, Acts 22. And it came that as I was on my way to Damascus about noontime, a very bright light suddenly flashed from heaven all around me. Now that's pretty impressive, isn't it? It's noon and it's sunny and you got a light that flashes around you that makes the sun look dark. Well, that would be Jesus. Okay? He's getting his attention. And I fell to the ground and heard a voice saying to me, Saul, Saul, why are you persecuting me? Because remember, Saul is his Hebrew name. He changed it to Paul because he's going to the Gentiles. But Saul is his Hebrew name. And I answered, who are you, Lord? Who are you, Lord? And he said to me, I am Jesus the Nazarene whom you are persecuting. All right, so he got read the riot act right there. And the story about that, you know, he goes blind and then he gets to see, you know, that whole thing. That's a whole other story. That's fun to, also fun to study. Following Paul's conversion, he eventually returned to Jerusalem where in a trance he received. Now this is why he should not have gone back. A prophecy from the Lord that he should have remembered and obeyed before he decided to return to Jerusalem. And that was in Acts 22:17. And it came about when I returned to Jerusalem. Remember, he was off in the woods, in the desert for a while. Following his conversion in Acts 9, he was praying in the temple and he fell into a trance. Now, that was the kind of some of the things that happened in that first century of the church. Doesn't happen today. Part of the credit card gifts that God gave the first century. Remember, a lot of the gifts are gone. But the apostles had them all, basically, all the gifts. They could heal people. They could do miracles. They basically had a blank check. Verse 18, and I saw him, that would be Jesus, in a Christophany, saying to me, make haste and get out of Jerusalem quickly because they will not accept you, your testimony about me. So he should have known. He's going to go back there to where Jesus told him to get out because they were not going to accept what he had to say. He knows this is Jesus and he's going against his direct command. Right? That's pretty crazy. And I said, Lord, they themselves understand that in this one synagogue after another, I used to imprison and beat those who believed in you. So he's arguing with God. They know I was a big man on campus and I was working for them. AKA Satan. And now I'm not. I'm working for you. But he didn't listen. Can you imagine? That just tells you just how egregious his sin was. And again, this is the right thing done in the wrong way, at the wrong time, or a wrong person. Now that's interesting. How about that idea? It might have been right for what was right. I mean, for other people to go there, like Peter and stuff. But it was not okay for Paul. See, he could commit a sin that you couldn't commit. And it was directly violating God's command. Now, nobody else had that command, of course. But he did, and he knew it. Okay. You expect to go back there and get hammered, which is precisely what happened. Verse 20, back to our string. 22:20, Acts. And when the blood of your witness Stephen was being shed, now this is interesting, I also was standing by approving and watching out for the clothes of those who were staying. Remember, Stephen got stoned to death, and someone had to watch their coats because they had to pick up the stones to throw them. Stephen was a deacon, all right, and he was evangelizing. He was an evangelist and a deacon, and the Jews, they were angry, and he actually saw Jesus in a Christophany as he was dying, and Paul was there, egging him on, all right. That just tells you where he was in this story. And the Lord said to me, "Go, for I will send you far away to the Gentiles." So Jesus is getting back to him. I'm challenging him. God says, no, you gotta get out of Dodge. Because he was in Jerusalem at this point. This was back in Acts, earlier in Acts. Verse 22, in the NET version. And they listened to him until he said this, and then they raised their voices and shouted, away with this man from the earth, for he should not be allowed to live. So this really aroused the crowd, the mob. They weren't happy. And so they're gonna come after him again. I mean, because they already had him, and then he got freed by the tribune, and then the tribune, then he had Paul ask him, well, I want to talk to these guys. And the tribune said, Yeah, sure, why not? The Tribune's kind of a cool guy. It makes you wonder if he wasn't ultimately saved. Probably was. But he let him talk. And then, but then he'll do it again. You'll watch. He's going to do it again. Because he didn't want to get involved with this mess. That was the big problem with the Jews. The Romans just didn't want to deal with it. Because it was just not a no-win situation for these guys. I mean, every time somebody got assigned to that region, they ended up getting fired. And that wasn't good. And the reason they got fired is because the Jews always got out of control. And finally, Titus said, forget this crap. I'm going down there. I'm going to waste those people, and they ain't going to ever have caused me any more trouble. Which is what he did. See, that's called the fifth cycle discipline, 70 AD. So Tribune Claudius was watching all this, and he decides that things were about to get out of control, so he had Paul taken into the barracks and determined to get to the bottom of the controversy by scourging Paul until he confesses his wrongdoing, Acts 22:24. Now, this is interesting. He's going to waterboard this guy. I mean, that would be today's technology. So they're going to beat him until he comes out clean. Oh, they did that with Jesus, remember? They beat him until he came clean. Of course, he came clean. He said he was Jesus, or Son of God. That was the clean. Of course, that was why they took him to Pilate. So that was, I mean, I don't think that's a very good way to get the truth out of somebody, but that was common. And I think we still kind of practice that kind of stuff with certain people that we kind of know are bad, even though maybe we're not supposed to. Well, the liberals don't want us to do that. Under Roman, but this is the real interesting part of this. Under Roman law, a Roman citizen, of course they don't know he's a Roman citizen yet, may not be scourged. Therefore, Paul realized that the Tribune was unaware of his citizenship. See, the Tribune is very sensitive to the rules, which is a good thing. That's what saves Paul. And he told the centurion who was preparing to scourge him of this, and the centurion told Claudius, this is in Acts 22:25-27. There's an interesting dialogue here. This is where, I'm not going to read the whole thing, but it's interesting. A commander came and says, tell me, are you a Roman? And he says, yes. The commander said, I acquired this citizenship with a large sum of cash. And Paul said, I was born a citizen. So, anyways, they were not, everybody, no one wanted to touch him after that. And with good reason, because if he got, they got reported to Rome after they treated a citizen poorly, they would have been fired, and maybe worse. You didn't get fired from the Roman army very easy. Generally, you got dead. So they were very afraid when they found out he was a Roman, because he had already put him in chains. They weren't allowed to do that either. There's a whole bunch of things you couldn't do under Romans law, as if you were Roman. Now, they could do anything they wanted to a non-Roman. So, under Roman law, a Roman citizen may not be scourged, therefore Paul realized that the Tribune was unaware of his citizenship. He told the centurion who was preparing to scourge him of this, and the centurion told Claudius. In verse 27 of Acts 22, the Tribune Claudius came in and says, are you a Roman? And he says, yes. And the Tribune answered, I acquired this with a large sum of money. And Paul says, I was born that way. Verse 29. Therefore, those who were about to examine him immediately let go of him, and the commander was also afraid when he found out. So the commander, remember, he's a boss over 1,000 men. That's pretty serious. Pretty high guy. Afraid when he found that he was a Roman because he had already put him in chains. So you notice those chains would have come off right now, basically. Roman citizenship had many privileges, and one of them was that citizens were exempt from the cross-examination under torture. Roman law required that a trial of Roman citizen was a precise procedure that must be followed. There had to be a formal indictment of charges and penalties, a formal accusation, and a formal hearing before a Roman official and his advisors. And what's going to happen to Paul over the next 2 years is this is going to happen. He's going to be in and out of the doors of the bosses for 2 more years in Caesarea before he actually ends up appealing to Caesar, and that sends him to Rome. We're not going to go into that, because he's under the aegis of the Romans right here from here on, basically. Well, there's one last thing that he puts, the Tribune puts him into the Roman hand or the Jewish hands for a little bit here, just because he doesn't want to have to deal with this. He knows it's a Jewish matter, and the Romans don't care. I mean, he didn't break any Roman law. Remember, you could be anything you wanted to be as a subject of Rome as long as you didn't violate their rules relating to the Caesar. So they didn't care. They were agnostic. You can do whatever you want to do. Just don't don't take up arms against us and don't blaspheme the Caesar. You can just do that and you're good. Remember, the Jews tried to get Jesus about the Caesar, about paying taxes. And Jesus outsmarted him. He picked up a coin off the ground and says, whose picture's on this baby? And they said, Caesar. Well, render under Caesar the things that are Caesar's and render under God the things that are God's. That answered that question. See, they had it. I mean, they were trying to get him. They were trying to say, well, you don't have to pay taxes to Caesar. That's what they thought. They were trying to dodge their taxes all the time. And so Jesus nailed on that one. Whose picture's on that? You know? He's minted in the coins, baby. You owe him the money, if it's appropriate, of course. So a verbal claim of Roman citizenship was generally accepted at face value because the papers that validated a person's citizenship were kept in the family archives and were not usually carried in person. And the penalty for falsifying documents or making false claims of citizenship was very severe and often included being put to death. There's examples of that. Someone claims to be a citizen to get out of a bad treatment, and then they find out that he wasn't a citizen, and of course he's dead, because you can't do that. So that kind of makes the law kind of what you want to comply with, right? Yeah, I think so. Since Paul was a Roman citizen, before formal charges could be sent to Rome, the commander had to know what the charges were. See, now he doesn't understand because he's not Jewish. The issue with Paul is Christianity. And Christianity at the time was a sect of the Jews. That's where it came from, remember? We saw that. It came from Jerusalem and Judea. And so it was another division of the Jews. And we're going to see a division of the Jews here already that was accepted and tolerated. But Christianity was not. Because Jesus was the true God and Satan didn't want to hear about that. That's the real reason. Remember, when you're up against opposition, don't ever forget Satan's behind the scenes here. Don't ever forget that. Because he's there. A lot of the stuff that's going on is related to Satan's influence. And the people that are doing it are just pawns. They may not even, they don't understand what's really going on. I mean, sometimes they might a little bit. They understand the scope of what's happening, really. They don't. So you just gotta leave it alone. It's up to God. The battle's the Lord's. And we really have to think that way. You know, I think this COVID thing is going to be real interesting to see. And how that all plays out. I think it's going to give our country a bunch of time. When God gets done hammering China, there ain't going to be no China left. That's just a side note, but I'm just saying, the only place that COVID is doing anything right now is where? China. Yeah, they're locking down that whole country. They ain't talking about it much. They've got trouble. That's going to make, I mean, they thought they were going to be big man on campus and compete with us. Sorry, not happening. They ain't going to have a country. This keeps up. And it's going. It's knocking on the doors of Beijing right now as we speak. They do what they did there in Shanghai? I don't know. I think that this is going to be turning a curse into a blessing. That's what I think it's going to be. We'll see. I might be wrong. Tribune Claudius wanted to avoid this and that the Jews resolved what appeared to him to be a Jewish problem without his interference. So that's what he tended to do. The Romans didn't want to deal with it. So he released Paul to the Sanhedrin. Now this is interesting. He's back with the Jews again. But he's got him on a real short leash. The ruling body of the Jews so it could make its own judicial ruling. So he's actually trying to, I talk about above my pay grade, he's going below his pay grade. He's saying, "You guys, this has showed up on my front door, but I don't want to deal with this. You do it." So he's going to give them a chance. It ain't going to work, of course, because Paul has to have the big guy. He has to have Rome, and he has to have a divine establishment, and that's where Jesus is going to put him. The Sanhedrin was the supreme native court in Rome. Jerusalem. That Rome continued to allow function in Judea under his aegis. So the Sanhedrin had the jurisdiction over, basically over Judea and Jerusalem, which is maybe 20-mile circle around Jerusalem. It's one of the reasons why Jesus could get out of Dodge and get out of trouble. Because if he was in Jerusalem, he was under the aegis of the Sanhedrin. But if he went to Galilee, he wasn't. So he could go over to Jerusalem and get in all kind of trouble, which he did. And then he could go back to Galilee and they couldn't touch him. Because they were under the same rule. Okay? In fact, they were actually under different Roman rule. Okay? So, because Herod didn't run Galilee. Right? So, it's interesting to the politics of the region. It's interesting to the story. So, the Sanhedrin ran the show. And they were the ones who ultimately put Jesus, you know, they're the ones who put Jesus to Pilate. They ended up putting him on the cross. Now, God had a plan. And what did he tell the boys down in the valley before he went up on that day, a couple of days? I have to go to Jerusalem to die. He flat told them that. And that's when Peter says, no, Lord, you can't do that. And he said, get behind me, Satan. They were down by the river when he said that. Okay? That wasn't in the jurisdiction of the Sanhedrin. Okay? So, that Sanhedrin was, again, that Rome allowed those guys to run the show in Jerusalem and Judea. That was it. The Sanhedrin dealt with all local judicial matters that the Roman procurator did not want to deal with, which was most. He didn't want to deal with that. Because he didn't care. He didn't want to deal with their religion. Most of the Jews' issues were always religious, as we're going to see in a minute. In this case, the Jews, the Sanhedrin, was the final appeal of questions regarding the Mosaic Law. Because the Romans didn't care. And if, see, that was the thing. See, the Jews were all tied up in a knot about the Mosaic Law. What was what for that? Okay? It was all religious. And the Romans, forget that crap. We got nothing to do with that. They did, that's how they ran the show. Everything was autonomous under their aegis. As long as you didn't go against their rules, they'd kill you in a heartbeat if you did. Which they eventually did, of course. Because the Jews just wouldn't shut up. If and when the Sanhedrin pronounced sentence of death, ratification by a Roman procurator was required. See, this is why Jesus had to be brought before Pilate before he was crucified. See, that's why they had to go there. They had to get authority from Pilate to kill him. Well, it turns out it's on a Saturday. Well, it's not a Saturday. It's on a holy day coming up. So the Jews didn't want to do it anyway. So they were kind of delegating upward here with Jesus. So, but anyway, that's why that had to happen. That's why there were so many trials with Jesus. And why Pilate actually exonerates him and then still lets him get killed. Of course, that was the will of God. You know, he came to die for that purpose. So there's no getting around it. The Roman authorities reserved the right to take over at any time. So they were always sitting there waiting and watching and proceeding independently. Further, the procurator or even the tribune of the cohorts in Jerusalem could act independently. So they weren't restricted to the Sanhedrin, but they generally did delegate to them because they just didn't want to deal with it. And you can't really blame them. Because they didn't understand it. They had no interest in it, and it wasn't, we don't care. So it makes perfect sense. So we see the tribune Claudius exercised his authority in convening the Sanhedrin in Acts 22:30. It's a couple of verses down. So the next day, wishing to know for certain why he'd been accused, that'd be Paul, by the Jews, he released him and ordered the chief priests and the council to assemble and brought Paul down and set him before them. So he puts him right in the middle. And Paul gets to talk. So he gets to witness these guys again. So that's kind of a good thing, I guess. I mean, he wasn't supposed to be there, but since he's there, he might as well say some words. In his defense, and it's interesting how he did what he did. Smart guy. You want to deal with a problem like that? This is how you do it if you understand what's going on. Of course, he knew this stuff. This was his training. He was a Pharisee of the Pharisees, remember? In his defense, that is Paul's defense, before the Sanhedrin, Paul used his knowledge of the conflicting theology between the Pharisees and the Sadducees to disrupt the court and render it feckless. Alright? That's what he did. You'll see how he did it. It's pretty cool. Smart guy. Brilliant. I mean, can you come up with this story? I mean, I can't imagine he saw this. So, verse 6 of Acts 23. Perceiving that one part were Sadducees, and he knew this, because the Sanhedrin was comprised of 50-50, basically, and the other was Pharisees, Paul began crying out, or speaking, in the Sanhedrin, "Brethren, I am a Pharisee, son of a Pharisee, and I am on trial for the hope and resurrection of the dead." Now, that wasn't really true. He was on trial because he was a believer in Jesus. Well, but the thing about this is believers in Jesus do believe in a resurrection of the dead. So the Pharisees happen to be right about this. So he takes up that cause, and he believed that. As a Christian, you'd believe it. So it's true that's what a part of it maybe, but that's a stretch. They're really after him because he believed in Jesus. He didn't bring that up. Verse 7, and he said this, there arose a dissension between the Pharisees and the Sadducees, and the assembly was divided. So, Hey, you can't get a quorum when you've got the place divided against itself, can you? Well, that's what happened. So he brought up a facet of Christian faith that is in alignment with the Pharisees' view and our alignment with the Sadducees' view. Verse 8. Because the Sadducees say that there is no resurrection, nor an angel, nor a spirit, but the Pharisees acknowledge them all. See, the Pharisees were right. See, the Pharisees, well, we'll see it here in the notes. The Pharisees is a more traditional religious group. The Sadducees were political, more than they were religious. Right? So there arose a great uproar, and some of the scribes of the Pharisaic party stood up and began to argue heatedly, saying, "We find nothing wrong with this man. Suppose a spirit or an angel has spoken to him." So, see, they take Paul's side because of the way he sets it up. Brilliant. Verse 10, Acts 23. And a great dissension was developing, and the commander was afraid Paul would be torn into pieces by them, and ordered the troops to go down and take him away from them by force and bring him back to the barracks. So he gets yanked out of there for his own protection again. Second time that's happened. Paul knew that if he addressed the issue of the Mosaic Law, the United Sanhedrin would convict him on the crime of blasphemy that carried the death penalty. See, if he had said he believed in Jesus and that was the issue, then they would have been united and he would have been toast. But he didn't do that. So think about that when you're in a situation like this. Be smart about the way you present yourself. Maybe you can make the court feckless like he did. That was pretty good. And of course, the boss, the tribune, is watching this whole thing. As a Pharisee, Paul knew that the composition of the Sanhedrin consisted of many Pharisees and the opposition party, the Sadducees. He also knew that there was an intractable theological divide between these two parties that, if exploited, would create chaos and guarantee the dismissal of the case, which is precisely what happened, of course. He therefore presents the idea that what's really happened, really been tried here, is the belief in the resurrection of the dead. The Pharisees and Sadducees were denominations within Judaism. So they had, again, they had their different theological perspectives. The Pharisees held to extreme exactness of keeping of the Mosaic Law. They had developed an oral tradition, a set of rules that must be followed in order to remain orthodox. Salvation depended on precise observation of the law, keeping of the law, through the exacting execution of the ritual. And although the Pharisees were unbelievers, they did accurately believe in the resurrection of the dead and the existence of angels. See, even people that are unbelievers can understand certain truths sometimes. That was the situation here. And the Sadducees were more liberal. Typical, you know. They did not believe in angels or the working of miracles or the concept of the resurrection body. Right? So you had the same kind of divisions you have today in Christianity within Judaism. But then the Pharisees held sway regarding the law generally because they were the teachers of it. So as a Pharisee, Paul knew that if he personally aligned himself with the Pharisees' belief in the resurrection, they would be bound to support him since they would defend their position before the Sadducees. And this is exactly what happened. When disruption broke out in the Sanhedrin, Tribune Claudius intervened, which he had authority to do, and he sequestered Paul in the military barracks to protect him from the Jews. So he really knows now that we got problems here because these guys aren't going to be happy. And they weren't. Now, we're not going to get to this part about the 40 people that are going to kill him because it gets redundant. But he's constantly under assault. Well, the Jews are constantly trying to get him. That's what's ultimately going. So the Romans take up... I mean, that's an interesting part of that story. Well, if we have time, we'll get there. If I don't get there, we won't go there. That the Romans, actually, what they did to protect him from them, the 40. We'll talk about that if we have time. The very next night, you can read the Acts here, see it too. It's just good. It's a perfect example of how God comes through for his people in the middle of nothing. I mean, Paul claimed that Paul was a Roman, and so he got protected because he was. Now, if it had been anybody else, they would not have got protected. The only one that could do this was Paul. The rest of the disciples were not Romans. All right? Paul was. So that gave him a special situation, especially with the Gentiles. And of course, that's why God picked him for the job, one of the reasons. The very next night, so now here we see where Paul's got his head back on straight. The Lord revealed himself to Paul in a Christophany, another one. What the Lord says indicates that Paul had rebounded and that the overruling will of God had delivered him from the sin into death. So God is using his protocol, in this case, establishment, to save Paul. But now Paul is going to be on the Lord's mission again. So he's been out of fellowship here. But now he's back in. He's seeing what's going on. I think he finally figured out that he shouldn't have come. He shouldn't have violated a direct command from Jesus. Not a good plan. Anyways, that's what he did. But the Lord does. And so verse 11 of Acts 23. But on the night immediately following, the Lord stood at his side and said, "Take courage, for as you have solemnly witnessed to my cause at Jerusalem, so you must witness in Rome." And so that's where he ends up, witnessing to Nero and the boys. That didn't go over well either. So, but, you know, that happens. It takes him 2 years to get there, though. Which is kind of sad, actually. Because it's what, man, what, if he'd been in directive will of God the whole time, just think what might have happened. You know, again, God turned the curse into a blessing, in spite of him. You know, he shouldn't have gone. Paul is now in the hands of the Roman authorities, the Gentiles, just as Agabus had prophesied in Caesarea. Remember, we saw that. When he's on his way over, he stopped in Caesarea, and Agabus and a bunch of the prophetess people there told him, "You're going to come out of there in chains." Agabus took the belt of Paul's belt and tied himself up with it. He said, "This is what's going to happen to you." We also see here how Jesus controls history with his overruling will by using the laws of divine establishment, as expressed in Roman law, to overrule the Jewish court and prevent the mob from murdering Paul. So I think that's the end of our class. So I got a minute or two. I can tell you what happened. Right after this, a conspiracy to kill Paul. This is it. When it was day, the Jews born of conspiracy to bind themselves under oath and would neither eat or drink till they killed Paul. And there were more than 40 who formed this plot. So, I mean, see, the Jews were thwarted because the tribunes stepped in and stopped them from killing him. And they're not happy. So they're going to go to war. Well, it ain't weren't going to go well for them. They came to the chief priests and elders and said, "We have bound ourselves under solemn oath that taste won't eat nothing until we have killed Paul." And so the council, and therefore you and the council, notify the commander to bring him down here to you as though you were going to determine this case by more thorough investigation. So they're going to try to mandate, they're telling the tribune what he's going to do. I mean, we'll talk about chutzpah, huh? Well, that's typical. That's why they ended up getting toasted eventually. But the son of Paul's sister, so he got some relatives in the region, heard about their ambush and came and entered the barracks and told Paul. And Paul called out to the centurion and said, "Lead this young man to the commander, for he has something to report." So he took him and led him to the commander and said, "Paul, the prisoner called me to him and asked me to lead this man to you, since he has something to say." The commander took him aside and, stepping aside, began to inquire of him privately what he had to say. And he says, "The Jews have agreed to ask you to bring Paul down tomorrow to the council, as though they were going to inquire more thoroughly about him. So don't listen to them, because more than 40 of them are lying in wait for him to have and have bound themselves under curse not to eat or drink till they slay him. And they are ready and waiting for the promise from you." So the commander let the young man go and instructed him not to say anything. So, here's how he moves him down here. He called himself two of the centurions and says, "Get 200 soldiers ready by third hour of the night." So he does this in the middle of the night. "To proceed to Caesarea with 70 horsemen and 200 spearmen." So he's going after these guys with 270 people. With weapons. Heavy weapons for that time. Alright, good luck. "And they were also provided mounts to put Paul on and bring him safely to Felix the governor. And he wrote the letter having this form." So, anyways, they brought him back to Caesarea. That's where Felix was. And next day he ends up in front of Felix or something shortly thereafter. That's interesting. But that's what the tribune did there. 270 guys to protect Paul for the trip. Driving in a car these days is about 35, 40 miles. And it takes you probably an hour and a half because of the traffic and the windy roads. So it would have taken them a while to do that. Probably about the same as today, because they'd probably go about as fast as cars, because the roads are really bad between those two points, even still over there. So we'll go back to our Roman study next time. Father, we thank you for the opportunity that you provided for us to study your word, and the blessing it is to see what you've done for your people, in this case Paul, and how you've delivered him, in spite of the fact that he directly rejected your command. It's amazing. That's so, and you came through and he rebounded and he's back on track to go to Rome and to witness and testify for you, and of course write half of the New Testament. So we thank you for your grace and continuing support in all cases, no matter what we face, because you have your unfailing love for us. And we thank you now for this. In Jesus' name, amen.